Thanks for listening to the Rising Coaches Podcast. Today we are joined by Kareem Richardson of Indiana State University. Kareem most recently was the head coach at UMKC for the last six seasons, and we dig deep into his experience there, things that he learned from his first head coaching job, things he would do differently. We talk about job selection, what is a good job, and then of course talk about his experience at Louisville working for Rick Pitino during the 2013 national championship season. It's a great conversation, really a lot of great takeaways, and we hope you guys enjoy it. Please subscribe to the podcast and please visit risingcoaches.com for more information on our latest events. Kareem, how are you?
Good, how about you?
I'm doing good. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, no problem at all. No problem.
So you are back in Terre Haute, which I just learned on our previous call here that it's called Terradice, for the second time in your career. The last time you were there was what, 2001?
2002.
2002. So what's changed in Terradice in all these years?
You know, our campus has grown. They've done a lot of renovations on campus with the dorms and expanded some things that weren't there when I was there previously. And so campus is really, they've done a great job on campus. And the town itself, a lot of things are still the same, but a little bit of growth moving towards south of town and whatnot. I was able to get myself pretty familiarized pretty quickly again.
Well, good. Well, congratulations on the job. And that kind of leads me to my first question is, this isn't the first time you've made a second stop at a school. So you played at Evansville and then later was an assistant at Evansville. Obviously, you were an assistant at Indiana State years ago, and you're back at Indiana State, and then you were an assistant at UMKC, and then years later became the head coach there. So what can you attribute that to?
I would say it's funny you even said that. I never even really thought about it like that, to be honest with you. But I would say that is just a tribute to good relationships and continuing to build relationships throughout, with my first stop, as a player at Evansville, I believe, just handle things the right way with people, even at a younger age. And then, from a coaching standpoint, whether it's, continuing to build relationships with athletics director or administrators and different things like that, but treating the bottom line and just treating people the right way.
Were any of those schools, was it the same people there from your first stop to your second stop, or was it complete turnover in terms of not just the coaching staff but administration?
Well, all the stops, and that's why I think it's very important. I mean, you asked about how that happens, and I think it is because of relationships, really. And all of the stops there were some people that were still there the previous time for me, getting there as a player. We had still some of the academic advisors and some, we had different athletic director from when I was a player, but some of the administrators were still the same people. And when I became an assistant coach at Evansville, when I was an assistant at UMKC, then became the head coach, there was senior associate AD was the same, that then eventually became our athletic director, and Carla Wilson, Tim Hall were the athletic director when I was an assistant there. And so every stop there were, it may not have been everybody, but there were still quite a few people there that was there from the previous time.
Yeah. So you obviously are doing something right. And obviously, like you said, do a great job of maintaining. It's one thing to create relationships when you're at a place, but I feel like maintaining that relationship after you leave is a whole nother ball game. And obviously you're great at
that.
No
question. No question.
So building relationships like across campus and on the other side of, with administrators, is that something you seek out to do or is that just kind of who you are? Or do you think people just, do you think you have a, and I know, I think I know what you're going to say about this. I'm going to say you have a presence about you. Do you think it's just that people take notice of who you are and how you carry yourself, and kind of keep that in the back of their mind?
Yeah, I don't, it's nothing about seeking. I mean, Gordon, you know me well enough. I'm not out there, you know, trying to self-promote or anything. And, but I think it's more just, you know, how I go about carrying myself and on an everyday basis. And again, I really go back. I mean, the same thing of just, you know, when I meet somebody and you know, looking them in the eye and talking to them and just, you know, really just being myself. And then, and I think one, you know, big thing is like, and when you see that person again, of having the ability to remember and have a little bit of background so you can continue conversations and treating people the right way and doing that. But it's nothing that I seek out. It's just, you know, I think it's a God-given gift that I have, and I'm blessed to have that a little bit.
All right. Would you say you're a people person, Kay Rich?
Yeah, I can be. You know, that's funny. And the reason I'm kind of chuckling, we did this Chad Brown, who does some of these. It's a form of the disc and things like that. I'm actually a really pretty quiet person, but when I'm around people, I have the ability to be able to you know, hold conversation and thing like that. So am I a people person? I'm not an outgoing, like I'm that guy. If I'm out at a function or a party, I'd much rather just sit in the corner and people watch if I can. But I know a lot of times I got to get out there and you know, mingle a little bit. But I'd much rather just observe. And I, that's why I love airports. I like people watching.
So you're posted up at the gate early, pretending that you're reading the newspaper, but you're really just like scoping out people walking by.
You're just scoping. Really, what I like, I like putting the headphones on so people think I'm just like,
right.
So nobody bothers me. I got the headphones on. I may not even have everything on, but I'm just kind of just scoping and peeping everything out.
Okay. And that's like you saying that you're not like you're, I don't know if you didn't use the word introvert, but you saying that you're, you know, kind of the guy off to himself surprises me because, you know, when you see you on the court, I've watched you in practice, like you are high energy, you are into it, you're interacting with every player, every person on your staff. So it's almost like you're completely different because, you know.
Yeah. And don't make me out to be a crazy guy, Gordo. I'm not crazy. But
no, you're not crazy. You're positive. But you're
no,
out there.
I do. Yeah, no. And I was like that as a player. I think that's kind of just been a little bit of my MO of like, yeah, I'm a quiet off the floor. I'm a pretty quiet to myself guy. And then on the floor, even as a player, like I you know, I was high energy. I talked and got guys involved. And that certainly it's carried over into my coaching style. And, you know, and one thing that you talk about with players, you know, trying to get the guys to talk and be, you know, you can be quiet and to yourself off the floor, but when we step in between those lines, like you got to get the voice going, you got to have energy, and that's how I am.
So, all right, you're just coming off your first head coaching job at UMKC, and did you have to transition that? You know, I'm sure you were always a high energy assistant coach. Did you have to find your voice as a head coach when you made that transition, or was it basically the same thing?
No, I think my goal, and I always, and I, you know, as an assistant, you always try to put yourself in position as what would you do and as an assistant when you became a head coach. And the one thing that I felt during my times of the really good coaches, and I've been blessed to be around, I mean, some good ones, and I think like the elites, the Chris Max and obviously Coach Pitino, Royce Waltman, starting things off for me in the Division I level. They weren't always talking. They allowed their assistant coaches to do a lot for them. And then when they did speak and their voice was heard. So I really took that. Again, it goes back to my personality. Everybody's got to be different. I'm not one that I just talk just to hear myself talk. I feel like when I do talk, it's of importance. And I took that same thing as a head coach. Our assistant coaches, they were probably more active and involved than I was. But when I did say something, I think that it really kept the guy's attention, and my voice didn't get, kind of like Charlie Brown, just hearing noise in the background and not, anything being conveyed to him.
And you had a great staff too at UMKC with AT and Hollander. I mean, you really were had some veteran assistants that you probably don't see a whole lot at the low to mid-major level that probably made that a little bit easier for you.
No question. AT was exceptional. He was our associate head coach throughout the tenure, very loyal guy for 6 years. When I wasn't there, whether it was out recruiting or I had to do another function or he was able to step in, I had all the confidence in the world. And when Chris Hollander was with me for those couple years, likewise, I mean, I knew things were going to be run the right way, and they weren't going. It wasn't going to be much slippage.
All right. So tell me, let's talk a little bit about like the experience there at UMKC. You were there for 6 years, and really, like, had some really good seasons. It looked like you were building and building, and you won 18 games, which at UMKC, I don't know the history of UMKC, but I'd say not too many people have won 18 games there and reached the CBI quarterfinals, had two, winning records in conference play. And then, I guess, what, did it take a turn the last 2 years? I mean, you guys are still obviously competitive, but what do you think the turning point was, and what do you think happened?
It's pretty easy. The year that we did win the 18 games, went to the quarterfinals of the CIT. It was we were young. We lost a lot, and we didn't stay old enough. I think we had so that year afterwards. I mean, shoot, we had six, seven newcomers. Not all freshmen, but newcomer guys, and it was a lot of turnover from that class. And then you had a couple key injuries in there for us. We lost some guys, and then we were we weren't able to get old again. And I felt again, this year would have been a year where similar to that year where we were there in the quarterfinals of the postseason, where we were juniors and we had seniors, a good mix, and some sophomores, and we were turning that corner again of the experience and getting old again.
So if you had to, if you could go back in time and do it again, does that mean you would recruit more transfers? You would sit some guys out? You'd be in the grad transfer market more aggressively, because I feel like you hear two things said a lot. Is one is, like you just said, you have to stay old, which no doubt. And then the other thing though that you hear other people kind of not complain about, but stress is, and I think there's a stigma that I don't agree with like transfers and JUCO kids, but they say, no, get program guys that you get young and keep in your system. And, they are brought up through the way that you want to play. So like, what would you do different? And like, where's the balance there between those two things?
I do. I think there's a balance. But where I would probably, Gordo, and I've thought about this a lot, obviously, when you get smacked with the reality of losing your job, and so at least I thought about what could I do differently, and it is it's nobody else, but it's self reflection of what I could have done differently, and about the only thing that I would have done differently is I would have taken or experienced a little bit more with transfers, done a better job of getting transfers, whether that you know, it's hard at that level of getting fifth year transfers. I mean, shoot, you think about fifth year transfers that are coming out of places like UMKC, shoot, they're going to Danny Dixon's going to NC State, you know, so it's hard to get a true quality fifth year guy at a UMKC, but I think I would have done a better job of getting Division One transfers, even Division Two transfers for that matter. There's a lot of great Division Two programs out there of guys can play at a higher level and to continue to keep that stream of old and getting you know, continue to get the junior college guys. I'm along with you a little bit. I don't agree necessarily with the stigma of junior college guys. I believe if people are in your program, meaning your assistant coaches, your administrators, your strength coach, and everybody is on the same page of the culture that you instill, then guys that are there, whether it's a junior college guy or a transfer or fifth year, they will pick up your culture and they will buy into it shortly after them getting on campus.
Yeah, and it seemed like you really, and I don't know, I'm an outsider, but I was able, we played each other a few years when I was at SEMO, and, you know, did go up there a few times and watch some practices. It seemed like your culture was really good. It seemed like you had great kids. And it seemed like, you know, you really had buy-in. So, you know, again, from an outsider's perspective, you were doing a great job, and winning 18 games at UMKC is no small feat. Because that is a very challenging job. All right, so I want to ask you about this now. Like, what would you, like, what advice would you give to your younger self or to anybody out there about, you know, being selective about jobs that you take and how important it is to take the right job and fit and from a resources and administrative standpoint?
Yeah, I think it's pretty – looking back on it, a younger Kareem or younger coach or whomever who's looking to become a head coach in a program. And we all, you know, you put your time in as an assistant. We all want to call a timeout for, you know, as many years as we can and see if our system will work. But the thing that I would tell a younger Kareem is to be really frank with you, being a black assistant coach, you know, getting a job, a head job sometimes, as a black assistant coach, we panic and we feel like, we need to take it. And I felt this way. Coming from Louisville, was like, hey, I don't know when my opportunity will present itself again. But the thing that one thing I would try to convey is to wait and see if you can get a job. It doesn't have to be at a Power Five school or an A-10 or something of that nature. But can you get a job? Position yourself to get a job where you're going to be top 1, 2, 3 in your league from a resource standpoint, from a tradition standpoint. And I think that's really key, tradition. Does your school have any tradition that you can recruit to? Whether, you know, I give you an example, I wasn't a head coach, but when I came to Indiana State the first go around over 17 years ago, even though there wasn't any consistent winning, you had Larry Bird to fall back on. You could talk about the 79 Bird team going and playing Magic, and there was there's tradition to fall back on the recruit. So when Rick Ray and Dick Bender, you know, were recruiting, you know, we had something, some substance that we could get guys and build, and then we were able to win. We went to two straight NCAA tournaments and had some success. And so that's where are your resources at the top 1, 2, 3 of your league? Is your tradition well enough to win, to recruit guys, even if it's old tradition? Do you have some tradition at your school? And is your administration and the administration and you as a head coach, do your visions align? And I know it's going to be a cat and mouse game as you're going through the, I call it a recruiting process, interview process of finding a job. You know, it's a, they're, you know, each person's probably going to say a little bit this or that to try to maybe please one another, but trying to dig in and see if your guys' visions align and are they going to support you when things are thin a little bit? Are they really going to truly support you?
No, that's great stuff. That's great stuff. I appreciate you opening up about that and being so honest about it. And you hear that a lot, but I would imagine that is probably the most important thing is try to get to a program that's, you know, top of your league. Because there's a huge difference between, you know, a UMKC and a Belmont. You know, there just is. I mean, it doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter who you are coaching. Like, one school is always going to be, you know, top three no matter what. And the other school is just scratching and clawing to be 500. And if you're above 500, you know, that's probably a good year.
Good year, right. And you know, obviously I could speak on UMKC. You know, to your point about Belmont, you know, there's a difference between New Mexico State and UMKC. You know, although I know UMKC is going to another league, but there is a difference. It is what it is. And so, you know, you try to battle and claw your way up there so you can get it done.
No doubt. All right. So now that you have the head coaching experience under your belt, do you have a different mindset going back to being an assistant? Or where? Tell us a little bit about like where your head's at now.
That's easy. My mindset's totally different now, being here at Indiana State with Greg Lansing and where that is, and you know, Gordo, I'm sure, and then I was like that as an assistant coach before I became a head coach. Is, you know, we feel like, man, if that were me, I would do this differently, and that and this would work, or we should be, you know, we should be doing this, or you know, we bring suggestions to the table without solutions a lot of times. Or we get pissed at our head coach that we're working with because he does something that may not necessarily be my philosophy in my mind, but now after being a head coach, it's bringing not just you bring ideas, but you have backing with your ideas, and you try to bring some solutions in my week time here with Greg, man. I'm selective of what I like. I want to be able to give him things that have substance, to things that are solution problem, and not just throw things on his desk. And I know his time. I understand how valuable his time is and what he's going through, and what, you know, he's got a whole program, and so, you know, he's got a lot of things he's thinking about, and he's trying to you know, put in, you know, figure, get his thoughts together and get his mindset together. And so whatever we could do as a staff now to put it on the silver platter for him is what we have to do. And I put it like this. I didn't understand when I became a head coach, I didn't understand the whole thing about hiring a former head coach. I'm like, man, I know basketball. You know, that's kind of my thought. I got a pretty high IQ. I know basketball, but now I get why coaches hire former head coaches now. I really do.
There's value in that, you know, having been there, in that
seat
before.
There's an extreme value in that, extreme value in that. And also not even with the head coach, but also other guys on staff. So you can mentor them, like, hey man, like when you bring something, you know, just so you can mentor the other guys that haven't done it and maybe shed a whole another light on them, you know, as fellowship, as being assistant coaches, that sometimes the head coach has so many things that he's pulled and turned from that he can't necessarily may be able to mentor like he wants to. But now you got a guy like myself that has been there. I feel like I can mentor, you know, a couple guys that are on our staff or GAs or managers that want to get in this profession, but maybe see it in a whole different light.
Oh, that's great. Okay, the last time you were an assistant was obviously at Louisville, and you guys won the national championship. Talk a little bit about what you learned, number one, from Coach Pitino and that experience, and then also, you know, just the experience of going through, you know, a national championship run. and what that's like?
Well, Coach P, my experience with Coach P was icing on the cake, so to speak. You know, I was at that point in time, I was an assistant for 16 years prior to getting a coach, and then I've been, you know, I bounced around Gordo and still bounced around. I've been with a lot of great minds, and I had in my mind philosophies that I knew I wanted. If I ever had the opportunity, I wanted to play fast. I knew I wanted to press. When I was in high school as a player, we pressed and we ran. We were the Loyola Marymount of high school back then. That was our style of play was from there. So it wasn't because I worked with Coach Pitino that I got into pressing. So the icing on the cake was learning caveats to pressing and some different things that oh man, I never thought, you know, when you do this or you do that with your pressing that this could happen, or you know, so that was the sort of the icing on the cake from a style play and pressing and different caveats of the pressing and zone matchup zone and different things like that. But probably even more so off the floor of learning from what I learned from Coach P again, icing on the cake is of how to run a program and the caveats of running a program. And, you know, we hear it all the time, being the CEO of the program and the business sense that he instilled in us as assistant coaches of the business world of it. And not that, you know, not saying, hey, we're going to be cutthroat this and that, but, you know, things like diversifying your ability to make incomes, not just relying totally on coaching, but are you investing the right way? Are you trying to do, you know, like Coach had the Dunkin' Donuts, he had the car dealerships and just putting different things in your mind because you know coaching is such a volatile career that path that you got to have different things going on. And so man, learned so much from that aspect just as well as coaching, and then the fine details of scouting. You know, he put some NBA twist on things when we're scouting that I shoot, you know, I'll give you an example, like, you know, one of his big things were because we played zone, we did a matchup zone and we also played straight up man to man. He wanted to know percentages. What does that team shoot against zone? What's their percentage against zone? What's their percentage against man to give us a better idea of like, okay, well, this game, we probably can't play as much zone because they shoot 60% against zone and they only shoot 45% against man. And then, you know, and then you throw in, well, what's their turnover ratio against pressing? What is their press offense? I never scouted a press offense, but it made sense. If you're going to press, well, you need to have the idea of what their press break is going to look like. So, you know, hey, are we going to trap first pass here? Are we going to get them a little bit more at midcourt because they do this, that, their press offense? So just the in-depth nature of the scouting as well was big time.
What? All right, maybe try to give me some insight, if you can, about how Coach Pitino is wired that allows him to be able to juggle, you know, his program and everything that goes along with that, along with, you know, a vast business portfolio and different industries and owning this many Dunkin' Donuts and car dealerships. Like I've been out of coaching for a month trying to run one business, and it is hard. It is hard work. I can't imagine doing this plus running a program plus having three other businesses. So like, what gives him the ability to do that? And maybe tell me if you know, like, what's his business background, or did he just figure it out, you know, trial by fire?
Yeah, I think it was more trial by fire, but also the guy doesn't sleep. He doesn't sleep. I know a lot of the great minds and great business people, they don't freaking sleep. Like, I mean, they are, you know, you're talking, you know, three, four, maybe four. Four is probably like a great night. I mean, a great night's sleep for the you know, the big time people that whether in whatever profession it may be. So that's the first thing. He doesn't sleep. His mind's always going. He's up at the crack of dawn. He's working out, you know, keeping his mind sharp. But he's also surrounded by a great team of people. You know, he's got, you know, a great business manager, agents good. And so I've talked about it, Rising Coaches. I talk about all the time with people is surround getting your team, you know, whether it's Team Gordo, it's Team Kareem. I talk about having the best, you know, financial, best agent, this and that, but he's surrounded by great people around him that allow him to manage a lot of those different things as well.
Okay, great. No, that's great stuff. And what about the championship run itself? I mean, one thing that I hear talking to people who have been through that is how exhausting it is. It's a whole extra 5 weeks on your season. But what else, you know, what are some other takeaways from that run other than obviously
super,
being awesome?
Super exhausting, especially, again, when you're with a guy like Coach Patino, who is so in depth with the scouting that I mean, you've got to be on your P's and Q's with everything because you're, again, I quickly, you know, we're pressing, we're matchup zoning, we're manning. So then you throw in there, how in depth it is to go over underneath out of bounds plays. And if you run 100 underneath out of bounds plays, we're going to descend 100 underneath out of bounds plays differently. We were taking away everything that you did was guarded slightly different than the other thing once we knew it was a set. So it was definitely very exhausting. And coming into that championship run, they were coming off of a Final Four the previous year. And I felt that there was, I didn't realize it at first, but as the year went along and as we got closer to the Big East tournament and then we got into the NCAA tournament, Coach knew we had a great chance to win it all. And now you think about that type of pressure of like, hey, this guy, Coach Patino, really thinks like we should win it all. He didn't say that publicly, but I could start feeling it and the things that he would say and how he was working the guys and getting ourselves prepared to be the most well-conditioned team that we were going to win the national championship. Well, then within that run, we had it was so awesome because of the stories within the stories that we had on our run. A lot of people don't know. Luke Hancock's father was you know, he was battling cancer. It was you know, his days were numbered of being. And Luke Hancock's dad made it. He wasn't supposed to make it, but he made it through. He made it through to see Luke Hancock become the most valuable player of the Final Four. And then he, you know, shortly after, he ended up passing away, unfortunately. So we had that story with Luke Hancock's father battling cancer. Obviously, the well-known story of Kevin Ware, you know, the compound fracture of his leg in the Duke game there in Indianapolis to go to get us to the game, the Elite Eight, to go to the Final Four. We had that story and the how traumatic that was. And then, you know, the way and prior to the way it was the Big East, that was the last year of the Big East tournament, the Big East that was known to be the Big East. You know, we go in there and we somehow miraculously come back from Syracuse. We're down. I mean, we're getting our butts handed to us in the Big East tournament by like 20 some points with about 15 to go in the second half. And we go on a hellacious run and we end up winning by like 20 or whatever it may be in the Big East tournament to beat Syracuse to go on to be the number one seeds. And if I'm not mistaken, at that time we had the biggest point, you know, win margin in NCAA history at that point. I mean, we were playing at a super, super high level, and then you got Final Four game against a Wichita State team, and we were pretty we played really tight that first semifinal game against them. We came Wichita State, Fred VanVleet, who was a freshman on that team, who just won a championship with the Toronto Raptors, was a freshman, and he took over and helped those guys. They were kicking our butts, and we somehow miraculously came back down. We were down 9 with probably about under 4 minute timeout, and we somehow came back. We kind of wore them down, and we were able to come back and get that lead, and then probably one of the best championship games were against Michigan, a high scoring game, great game there. Against those guys that go on and win it. One of the biggest things that I remember throughout the run was how intense it was and how intense Coach is with his coaching. Man, there were games in there throughout the year at the NCAA run where you're so involved in the games, and it is such a high level. And Coach coached every play. That's it. He literally coached every single play from as soon as that ball is thrown up in the air until the final buzzer. And you look up at the scoreboard, and you're like, "Damn, we beat these dudes by like 30 points," and you would never know. You're so involved in it that. That seriously, like you look up first round of the NCAA tournament, we're playing North Carolina A&T in the tournament, and let Coach tell you, have you believe, like we're going to get beat. There's no way we're going to beat. We're the number one seed, and we beat them by like 50. And you don't know because it's that intense and how intensely he coached the game.
So he's not a Brad Stevens type, you know, once the game starts, my job is done. Like, he's getting after it.
No. He Coach P is and Kevin Keats and Y. King Jones told me this before. He's like, Kareem, he will joke with you before the game, he will joke with you out on the floor, but as soon as that ball is tossed in the air, he is a different person. Like as soon as that ball leaves the referee's hands for the jump ball, it's game on. Like he is drenched. He's cool, calm. He looks that way, but he gets out of his suit. He's drenched. He coaches every single play.
That's awesome. Well, I know we're running long on time, but like I want to get to this quickly. Tell us a little bit about Chris Mack and your experience there at Xavier, because that's another Hall of Fame coach that you worked for.
Chris Coach Mack is he's up there. I tell people all the time, no doubt about it. Then Coach P is the best that's done it, and Mack is right there. He's right. Mack is he's great with the kids. He instills a confidence in guys that's no other. Like he can instill in you and I, Gordo, right now to think that we can go out there and score 20. And he'll infuse so much confidence in us and so much swag in us that we'll go out there right now and give you 10. Like I don't know how he does it, but he infuses guys with so much confidence and instills it in their play. One through however many guys are on the roster, he does a magnificent job with his guys.
So is that – does he just have amazing individual relationships with everybody, or is it a way that he speaks to the group or speaks to individuals in front of the group?
The way he speaks to individuals within the group, and I'm not sure how well you know Mac, but Mac doesn't lack confidence himself. Like he's a very confident person. And he kind of has an air about him as well. And you talk about presence; he's got a great presence about him. And he doesn't speak that part that we talked about earlier. When he talks, it's meaningful. It means a whole lot. And he has a great ability to to get the best out of everybody on the roster.
Okay, and then finally, we can't wrap this up without talking about the legend, Royce Waltman.
Absolutely. Coach Waltman, Gordon, he's not a household name by any stretch.